This is a Beyond Cast Cerberus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCastCerberus.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast with Kay. I don't think we haven't had an interesting kind of intro before. I thought I would try that. I don't think it worked.
And
I think
we still haven't had an interesting intro. Good try.
Hey, but we're here. We're in. It happened. Let's just move past it and talk about this week's topic. Which this week's topic, let's be honest, it could take a week to completely fill the full scope of this topic, but we're going to try and do it for you in our usual hour-ish slot. But really, the reality of it is this particular topic is just vast. It's so vast because we're trying to cover at least a TV show that has 50-plus years of history, but more outside of that, considering it spans to TV shows outside its scope. But it is the reused aspect of props and sets within particular main focus, I guess, Doctor Who, but we're going to talk about other areas as well, which we just, James and I are prop guys in the respect that we both find interest in props and sets that are used within the TV shows and films that we watch. Go on.
Funnily enough, this could actually end up being the first of the prop casts with a K, couldn't it?
This could. Actually,
it could,
yeah.
Couldn't it? So, who knows? When you're listening to this, it might have a slightly different graphic depending on Emperor Crawley's feelings on this. This might end up being the first prop cast with a K. Who knows?
I do like this because I've got ideas for future prop casts, and this one slots right in there.
Brilliantly. So welcome to the prop cast with a K. Now owned and reinterpreted in this moment as the first prop cast. This was, as you said, a podcast. But maybe this should be the propcast with a K. We're in and we're ready to roll.
Whether or not it goes that way when you're listening to it, I'm still in. I'm with it. James and I are into the props of the show in a way that we're both fascinated by them, not to the same degree in that James doesn't quite collect them like I do. But we're into the props, we're into the sets, and even the costumes of the show. So we pay attention to those kinds of things, as I'm sure many of you out there do as well. But one of the things that you can't help but notice in a TV show like Doctor Who, and indeed many films and other TV shows, is that they reuse a lot of props. And sometimes they'll redress them. Sometimes they don't bother to redress them at all. They'll just rename them. And some are really obvious and some they hide rather well. So we thought we would talk about some of the reused props, certainly some of the big ones, and we'll do some honorable mentions. But as I was saying, it's a rather large topic to discuss where there's no way we're going to hit them all. And I'm sure there's some that maybe we haven't even noticed yet, and other ones that, while we've noticed maybe two or three different returns, we may not have noticed all of them.
Okay, so let me start on a question, which I think probably about 60 to 65% of the people listening to this will probably be asking.
Sure.
Why do you care?
You know, I'm a filmmaker, and I'm just interested in filmmaking in general. Let's say I'm even just a film connoisseur. Okay. Interesting to me from the standpoint, you watch a movie and you know how you can watch a scene and you'll see like, oh man, you know, in the long shot, and a long shot being a shot that shows, you know, two or three more people or even just a full body of a person, that character is holding a coffee cup. But when you go to the close-up shot, both his hands are empty now, you know, and we notice these continuity errors, as they're called, where somebody will write something on a blackboard and then in a different shot, the word that they wrote isn't there anymore. Those kinds of things, or it's written differently. They don't matter. They're not consequential to the storyline whatsoever. The filmmakers don't care. A lot of people look at them and they'll say, oh man, you know, they really screwed up that scene. You know, look at that continuity error. they don't care about that. They try and catch big continuity errors, but little ones like that, they don't care about, because if it's not interrupting their storytelling, what's the big deal? Everybody wants to be perfect, but we never get there. Then there's a different side of things where you go to make a movie or a TV show and you're given X amount of dollars for a budget to make this movie. And no one knows this better than Doctor Who, certainly the classic series, how far you have to stretch nothing into something for people like us to watch and enjoy. And I don't know, as an artist and as a filmmaker, looking at these sets, looking at these props, I'm fascinated by the design of lots of them. And I think they're just really cool items. Like, some people look at a lightsaber and think it's the ultimate kind of sword, or the ultimate kind of science fiction device, or a spaceship or a blaster. In Doctor Who, obviously, one of my biggest things is sonic screwdrivers. But there's been so many great designs within this show. And let's stick to Doctor Who here, since that's what this podcast particularly is about. There's been so many great designs in Doctor Who that sometimes you sit there and you say, man, that thing was used in one story. I wish it had become something more permanent. It's a cool design, kind of like how the sonic screwdriver stuck around. And other times it's just kind of fun. It's like pointing out the continuity errors. Look at that guy. He's wearing the same helmet as they were wearing in this other episode that's set on an alien planet in the future, you know, where this is present day. And I don't know if I can put it in the words.
But that's what's interesting is what is it in words? I mean, I know it gets a bit intellectual, but I'm just fascinated about what it is about it that is so fascinating. Because, as I say, there'll be 65% of people who won't really care. There might be less than that who actually enjoy, as you say, sort of talking about it. I mean, talking about some of the continuity errors. So they'll be looking at sort of, you know, where, as you say, not just the larger things, they quite like the smaller things as well. I mean, there's the famous Star Wars stormtrooper knocking his head on the door, which became a sort of pop culture moment. It's just interesting where the pleasure comes from this. Where is our pleasure coming from? Is it in the discourse that we can talk about it? Is it in that whole thing that it becomes almost like a puzzle, that we see things outside the story that we can capture? Is it also in some ways, is it also about other things as well? Like, for instance, you talk about your interest in different, in particular props. Is that sort of element of it, you know, whether it be a lightsaber handle or a sonic screwdriver, is it because they're sort of gateways to us imagining them as real? You know, if we could hold a lightsaber or sonic screwdriver, would we feel closer to the show? Would that make it more real to us? Which is interesting.
When you're saying that, it's kind of a few things to me. And in one hand, it's almost like a Where's Waldo, as you say, a puzzle. You know, you pick that book up, you know what you're going to do. You're going to look and try and find Waldo or any of the other miscellaneous items that they have for you to look for in those books. When you watch an episode, it's sometimes fun. Let's say it this way. On a rewatch of an episode, and it can happen on the first if you're paying attention, but on a rewatch of an episode and a rewatch, like we do with Doctor Who, many of us will do with Doctor Who and other TV shows that we enjoy, there's always something new to notice, either some plot point or a costume piece or a set piece or something. There's always something new to take away from it. And in some ways, continuity errors, reused props, or even just appreciating the props because beforehand we were focusing on the story at hand, is part of that thing. So in a sense, it's kind of like a Where's Waldo in that respect.
So in a sense, it's also a mark of revitalizing a story for us. It's a way to sort of perhaps reinvigorate an interest, because once you watch a narrative, you know what's happening. Right. You'll be less attentive to that factor. It's something being stripped away a little. You now know the structure of following the narrative. Now you know the narrative as a whole. So you start looking. Do we start looking for ways to reinvigorate that story on a second watch, and not in a sort of intentional way, but just naturally we start looking, and we now know the story, so we start looking at the story differently. We no longer look at it as a progressive narrative. We now know it as a total narrative, and we're sort of now able to start sort of pulling it apart, not out of pickiness, but just because that is the way that we now interact with the story, because the story's changed for us. It's a different,
right?
It's a different text, isn't it? Now it's no longer that what's going to happen next. We know what's going to happen next. That sort of, you know, that chronological has sort of synchronicity, it has gone. It's sort of asynchronous. We know every bit of it. We're not looking at it within time A, B, C, D. We know E, and we're now looking at C, thinking about A, and we're also thinking about E. So it's muddled around. I know this is a sort of very silly debate, but it's kind of interesting. Is that what changes that makes us start doing this? Because we don't tend to do it on the first watch, generally.
No. Yeah, some can, and sometimes you do find something on
especially
the first
if the story
watch,
isn't interesting you much. That can sometimes be a case.
True. You know, but I mean, think about, for example, the Armageddon Factor.
Yeah.
You know, I've watched that story, I can't tell you how many times over the years.
I'm so sorry. And
what was it, like a year or two ago, I noticed that in a scene when the Doctor is speaking with Drax, you can see a microphone clipped to the Doctor's shirt. And I've never noticed it before. And it never mattered before, because before what they were saying and what they were doing in the scene mattered. But because I watched the scene so many times, I was just letting my eyes wander and like catching. Sometimes I will watch a show that I have watched multiple times, and rather than look at the actors and what they're doing, which is misdirection in film, it's like what magicians do. They want you to be paying attention to the things they want you to pay attention to. So they set the camera angles with your eye looking where they want you to look. They'll set actors talking, because obviously you should be looking at them just like you're having a conversation with them. But when you've seen it multiple times, you can let your eyes wander and you can look at the background and you can see, you know, background performers not doing things they're supposed to be doing. You can see sets, seams for sets coming apart, or a prop that you've noticed before, a microphone on a different actor. I've even found one in the X-Files, and I have no idea how I even found this one, but there's a scene where Mulder and Scully are talking, and you can see a microphone hidden in the knot of Mulder's tie. And it's just ridiculous. And I only noticed that because I'd watched that story multiple times.
Yeah, it's just how the cigarette-smoking man is learning what they're talking about. He's hidden bug on Mulder, and he's just not noticed. But, yeah, no, it is interesting. And I think sometimes it can add to the story, because you can start creating your own sub-narratives to it. For instance, if you start seeing... I think a good example of this, and I can't think of any specific examples within it, but I think it's a good example just because of the sake of budget, is that Frontier in Space, where you have a lot of recycled elements to the ships and everything that are done for story purposes. But you could imagine within that universe, you having stuff which is replicated, props which are replicated. And even then you could link it to other futuristic stories in Doctor Who and sort of say, well, if you see that prop reappear again, is that just the same sort of prop being used sort of universally? Because in the same way that phone shapes for us are relatively the same. Is it that sort of thing? And you can start to sort of broaden it. Another obvious example, Hellbent, where there's one of the corridors in Gallifrey is also one of the walls in the first Doctor-like console room. There's that sort of slatted wall is used earlier on in the and it's just, again, it's just reusing, because that Hellbent console was just bits and pieces tacked on within a day. There was a rush to pull it together, so there was no real thought and rhyme or reason to it. But again, it makes sort of sense that you'd have the same wall of Gallifrey within a TARDIS. So it will create strands which aren't intentionally there. Well, probably maybe are to some degree. They probably thought, well, we can use this wall because it is a Gallifreyan ship. But the primary reason is budgetary. So, yeah, it's.
And that's the other fun thing about it, too, is that what was their intention for reusing this prop? Did they want it intentionally to be something different? Or did they want it to harken back to something that we already knew before to give us an idea that they're linked? Because both are used. And then you even have times where, similar to what you were saying with the Frontier and Space props or sets, you go back to Revenge of the Cybermen and the Vogon race. They all wear on their chest or on their walls, they have the what is now known as the Seal of Rassilon, which was then later used in Tom Baker's era, but certainly in the Five Doctors as the Seal of Rassilon. Mm. And then from there on out, it was used in the TV movie and lots of other places.
You imagine it's on everything on Gallifrey, mugs.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, right.
Pillows, condoms, you know, it's just, you know, it's not official and it's not safe. It hasn't got a seal of Rassilon on it.
But what's interesting about that one, though, is that while they just liked the symbol and decided to use it as an official symbol for Gallifrey, there's fan theories out there that say that somehow the Vogon race were kind of in league with the Time Lords, and therefore they adopted their seal. You know, they've worked with them, and stuff like that is interesting to me. It's not said in the narrative of the show in any way, but it can make sense.
And what is interesting about it is that these sort of things, and we can take this as a broader point, that you, first of all, you interrogate a narrative, then you find errors within the narrative, and then those errors can actually sometimes, and this can happen officially as well, can then reintegrate into narrative. They can be transformed from being external errors into internal continuity. And I must admit, there's not many that spring to mind on this, but they do actually happen where you'll find, well, okay, you can go, again, going back to the Star Wars with the Stormtrooper hitting his head. You know, when it came to redoing the special editions, they actually made, they actually made sure that was sounded, that was FX, that it now became, right, because it was acknowledged, it actually became part of the story rather than a mistake within the story. And there are examples of this. As I say, they're not springing to mind at the moment because we're just winging this. And I didn't think we'd be going down into this direction, where there are the mistakes do eventually can actually, as you say, become. And I know you're saying this is like a fan fiction theory, but sometimes these become embedded within the novels, or they come embedded within audios, or sure, they come embedded within the show. Mistakes which are then taken on and become fact. So sometimes finding these errors eventually becomes areas which authors will explore to reinvigorate those stories or to reinvigorate new stories. And I think that's kind of interesting. I mean, I don't know, a very obvious one would be, and say, Blink, where they make the comment about the square windows, which comes from a long, angry fan debate over the design, whether the design of the new police box and new series was accurate or not. And then it's referenced within the show and becomes, okay, that's not actually about props in the way that we're talking about it, or continuity errors as we're talking about it. But it's just showing how narrative to that consumption of narrative can then play back into the narrative again. So it can be quite interesting and relevant to that whole, to the whole thing. It's not just, you know, people being picky. Sometimes being picky creates holes or ideas which are then investigated later. And I think that's always a kind of an interesting thing there.
Well, and you'll always get fan theories for anything, and they can range from the absolutely absurd to the completely brilliant. And sometimes the good ones will make it, like you said, into the show, into books, into the comics, or even just through the fan circles enough that fans start to believe it after a while.
Yeah, absolutely. That's another way it happens.
But some of the absurd ones to me are things like when a prop is used both in, let's say a prop or a planet name or anything along those lines is used both in Doctor Who and we'll say Star Wars as well. Some fans will say, well, then they're clearly set in the same universe. Mm-hmm. You know, and so they have all sorts of theories for that. And examples, for instance, of this is, one of the best examples, because there is actually a Star Wars crossover, is spacesuits that were used in both the 10th Planet and the Wheel in Space in Doctor Who were used for a bounty hunter, the character Bossk, in Empire Strikes Back. Mm-hmm. But that suit itself was new to Doctor Who, or rather was not made by Doctor Who. It was first used in a film in the 60s called First Men on the Moon. But because that kind of link exists, you know, fans see that stuff and they start to think of theories like, where did Bossk get his outfit? Did he kill one of those space astronauts and take the outfit, you know, there from there? Are these universes connected in some way? And I don't buy into that kind of stuff, but it's interesting to see that not only do props get reused within one show, but they can get reused across properties as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Another good example is Blake 7, which naturally being made at the same time, we used a lot of BBC or Doctor Who props, sure, and vice versa, and has had Doctor Who links through fan productions like not even just through fan production, through official stuff, like Chris Boucher doing stuff for Robots of Death, which is linked characters from Blake Seven into it, has certainly given a question whether you could fit Blake Seven into that world, and given the aesthetic carries similarities because of the props, not just because of the props, but the music and obviously the wider aesthetic than just the props, the lighting and everything else that goes into the BBC production at the time, could make those fit quite nicely. So maybe we need to go through some of these, because people might be thinking, well, what examples are we talking about here?
Sure.
And I think there's some, we'll put, there is a website which has a lot of prop recycling on TV, or TV Tropes has a prop recycling area, doesn't it?
It's not just for Doctor Who. It talks about many different TV shows, and I don't just mean how props will cross through TV shows. They talk about props that are reused, period, within those TV shows, either within themselves or through other TV shows. So.
Well, the first one that we've obviously got is an example of that, where you got the sonic screwdriver, which the part of the prop was first seen in Thunderbirds Argo, the 1966 Thunderbirds film. And then was later seen in Colonies in Space as a handcuff key, and then in the same story as a sonic screwdriver.
Yeah, which is an amazing find for people like myself who are prop collectors and prop replicators, because it sometimes when you are a collector and you are trying to replicate a prop, but all you have are the shots that it was used on screen, where actors' hands are often obscuring it, you have to put details together yourself. And here, being able to go to a completely different show to get more details that might be missing from the other show is just incredible. And it's also incredible because we can find out things like, for instance, in the Thunderbirds, it was specifically made for the Thunderbirds. This was not a found item. And for years, fans have been trying to find the item that was used for the sonic screwdriver, because they all swore it was found, it wasn't made, because why would Doctor Who make something new out of metal? Well, they didn't. Thunderbirds did, and Doctor Who bought it. So now we know, and it saves us a lot of heartache trying to search for it, but gives us more information, which is great. But you also get another example of a found item, or rather of an item that was used in Doctor Who that wasn't created for Doctor Who, as the white robots from The Mind Robber, which they started in a BBC production of an Isaac Asimov story. And I forget the name of that one. I'm trying to quickly find it in my notes here. But they were not white. They were, I guess they were black or gray. And it was used in a story, an Isaac Asimov story called Reason, before they were ever used in Doctor Who. And it was just interesting because it was kind of like they knew they needed these robot suits and they were going to make robot suits. And then somebody was like, well, hey, why don't we just repaint these? And in some ways you get people, like, there are fans out there that are completely disgusted by the fact that a prop could be repainted and reused for something else. Not because they don't think that, you know, it's okay to reuse props. It's because now that original prop that was used in that Isaac Asimov story can no longer exist in its original form.
Absolutely.
It has now been repainted. You know, if you want to put that on display somewhere in an Isaac Asimov museum, you have to get one of those suits from the Doctor Who company or wherever they went after that and restore them back to their original.
I mean, there's pros and cons to that. I mean, to be fair, I think a lot of fans don't realize that repainting is actually very much part and practice of television and film. A
Absolutely.
Lot of stuff is repainted in various reasons, even within the shows, or to indicate, you know, it's not something, even sometimes just for one-off effects, they can be repainted and then repainted again. So that's never so much of a problem. I think sometimes the biggest problem, one that goes to Doctor Who, which I always think is a real crushing shame. I'm going to say it's a real crushing shame.
Uh-huh.
Is the Metropolitan Police box that was made, which was made for the Doctor Who movies, which was then blown up in an episode of the Avengers. Pyrotechnics were put into there and it was pretty much destroyed. So there I can genuinely see a real crushing shame there, to see such a very beautiful police box prop.
It is annihilated. A shame, but I agree with you that, you know, we as fans, we put more appreciation. We put more, I'm trying to find the best word here. we look at these props in kind of the same way that we would look as any of our own possessions. We try and treat them as nicely as we could. You know, your own home computer, your favorite album, a guitar, anything that you have, you want to keep it in pristine condition. And we like these props so much. They mean so much to us. You want that lightsaber because, man, for whatever reason, you feel like you are a Jedi and you want that lightsaber exactly as it was on screen. Which even brings up an entire completely different issue about props, but I'll get to that in just a second. But to filmmakers, and one of the best examples of this I want to talk about is from Fury from the Deep, which is a Doctor Who story. But to filmmakers, props are just a necessity to help tell the story, and they will do whatever they need to get that week's story told or that movie told. They don't sit there and go, okay, you know, except for companies like Lucas Limited, you know, where they'll keep an archive of these things because they know they may either use them again or George Lucas just thought, I want to keep and preserve these. And, they, you know, you will find certain props are preserved. But for the most part, especially with little hand props, a lot of times it's just this is going to be a one off thing in this one off story. OK, but. Real quick, before I get to the theory thing, let's talk about lightsabers or even sonic screwdrivers. Going to a movie like The Empire Strikes Back or even The Force Awakens, both are prime examples of this, and the classic Doctor Who sonic screwdriver that was used from John Pertwee up through Peter Davison. There really isn't an ideal or a classic original version of that prop. You know, we'll throw Star Wars into this mix because I know some people will say the prop was used from Empire and originally in Star Wars. And yes, it was, but that's exactly where I'm going with this. The prop was altered multiple times throughout its life and use in those films. And the reason why I chose Empire Strikes Back specifically is because the prop just doesn't differ from its first use in Star Wars, A New Hope, because those two props were altered between movies. So, mm-hmm. So the version that's used in A New Hope is very different from the one, not completely, but it's got a lot of differences to the one that's used in Empire Strikes Back. But all throughout Empire Strikes Back, there's multiple versions of that same lightsaber handle that Luke Skywalker uses because you needed one for stunts. You need one to be the hero prop.
Yeah.
Both the stunt and the hero prop are going to be dropped and broken. And you need multiple versions of each prop. So some of them have a glass eye. Some of them have a red button. Some of them have screws. Some of them have rivets. So there's no one ideal prop to copy. And for instance, when you get to let's use Christopher Eccleston era of Doctor Who. He had two versions of his sonic screwdriver that he would use. But one of them, there were four props made of that particular version. So if you keep looking at these pictures of this one version, and when I say versions, there's one with a stationary activation button, and then there's one with an activation button that can slide up and down the handle. If you keep looking at all the pictures of the stationary activation button and think you've got all the definitive details, well, you don't, because there were four versions of that prop alone. And then into the mix in a particular story, he's using the stationary button and the sliding button version of that prop intermixed in one story alone. So in any given scene, they could cut to the stationary prop or the sliding prop. So it's very difficult for collectors. We get so attached to things, but when you look at it and you realize, you know, some of us will look at it and go, okay, there's five different versions of that Empire Strikes Back lightsaber. I need all five. Some people will say, I need to go ahead and replicate just what I think is the perfect one. And some will say, I like the one from this particular scene. I'm just going to do that one. But at the end of the day, you know, none of that mattered for the film. All that mattered was that Luke was seen holding his lightsaber, using it in a scene so that we can enjoy the story that's being told.
But also at the same time, there is a factor that what is, as you say, is just a prop to tell the story. For a filmmaker, it becomes ultimately, like most historical artifacts, becomes transformative in the sense it no longer becomes a prop, it becomes emblematic, it becomes an iconographic element of that story, so much so that, you know, that when you come back 25, 30 years later to make The Force Awakens, or even when you come back to do Hellbent for Doctor Who, you know, audiences are expecting facsimiles which are very close identifications of those put together props, which were just props, but they're no longer just props. You know, the TARDIS, obviously they didn't use the original TARDIS set because they couldn't for Hellbent, but they used their approximation based on the Who experience,
yes.
Bringing the Who experience bit and then putting bits around it. You know, the idea for the audience that it was important to have something which, as closely as they could relate and believe to be that, just that narrative prop, as you say. And, you know, the term prop says it all, doesn't it, really? It's not something which carries, it's meant to carry significance, but it is transformative. It does create significance. Not all of them. Some of them don't. And that's what makes these tropes lists quite interesting, because a lot of the stuff on there people won't notice, but some of them are important. And as you say, yeah. Sonic screwdrivers are very much so. We will put a sonic screwdriver, the Thunderbirds screen cap of how it looked in Thunderbirds, which is inevitably different to the Pertwee version. There's less colour on it and there's no head to it. It's two obvious points. And interesting, if you actually do go and you check on Google for this and you click and you raise two images down from there, is Brian's sonic screwdriver set as an option to view. Yes, it's three images along, I think. Oh, no, wait, is that three images? Was it two images? It's the fifth image on the row for me. But, yeah, so, Brian, cool. You and your props are there. So do you want to just tell everyone briefly a little about the whistle... sonic screwdriver Fury from the Deep, because
yes.
A lot of people, and I include myself in this, was under the impression that the flashlight, as you see in the War Games, was most memorable from the War Games, because they used right. close-ups of it several times. The flash pen was the first sonic screwdriver, which isn't true.
Well, yeah, and that's the amazing thing is that even myself, for years, I just assumed that was the actual only prop that Patrick Troughton used, because, as you said, they give it more attention in that story than they had done in previous stories. Even the one prior to it, which was the Dominators, a lot of people assumed was the same prop because it was a cylindrical pen light looking device that had a handle on it. But the one in the Dominators is possibly it's definitely a different pen light if it's a pen light, or it's just a piece of pipe with a clip on the handle. So those two images alone, since those two, bringing those two up specifically before the Fury one, is because those two stories still exist. So fans can watch those. And going back to what we were saying earlier, when you're just paying attention to the story at hand, you think those two devices are the same. But when you really pay attention to it, when you've watched it a million more times or you specifically are looking at it, you can see how different they really are. But it's amazing what information we can still find out in today's day and age, because a story like Fury from the Deep, which is the first time a sonic screwdriver was ever used in Doctor Who, is missing from the BBC archives. So we always just assumed it was the same prop as the War Games yet again, because we didn't know any better. But now... as of a few years ago anyway, using behind the scenes photos of filming on the beach scene where the sonic screwdriver was used, and telesnaps, which for those who don't know, are actual photographs from particular stills of the finished episode, of the finished aired episode. We can actually see that the prop, the very first prop that was used for the sonic screwdriver, was actually just a life preserver whistle. And there's actually a story that goes behind that, but it's when you think about it, when you think about what the sonic screwdriver is and what it has become in the show and what it means to fans, in the same way that fans look at Luke Skywalker and his lightsaber, we look at the Doctor with his sonic screwdriver, and you realize that the very first one was just a whistle, it's very unimpressive. Hmm. But what you have to remember is, at the time, it was just a prop that was written for one scene in one story and presumably was never going to be seen again. But what had actually happened was, we all tried to figure out, why would a whistle be used? Why would the props department not have gone and found a pen light or built a different device or even used a screwdriver and just called it a sonic screwdriver? What's brilliant about this is that the answer actually comes from one of the actors, Fraser Hines, who of course played Jamie McCrimmon. He was asked what he remembers of that prop. And he said that, to the best of his knowledge anyway, that either an actual prop wasn't made or didn't arrive on set for filming. So to his recollection, what they did was, in his actual words, they used a bit of bric-a-brac from Deborah Watling's outfit. And Deborah, of course, played Victoria in the story. And in that particular scene where the sonic screwdriver is used, they're all wearing life preserver, life vests, life preservers. So they all have whistles, or excuse me, I don't recall if they all did, but certainly Deborah Watling had this white life preserver whistle attached to her outfit. And because they didn't have a prop for that scene, they used that whistle as the very first sonic screwdriver. The reason this is interesting is not just because we now know what it was, and, you know, that it adds to another sonic screwdriver pile, but what it means is it shows the ingenuity and the creativity that the props people or the directors or the actors even have to do on sets when things go wrong. No, it's not an impressive piece, but they found a solution so that they could keep telling the story rather than hold it up and film and wait until they had a prop to actually shoot the scene. So the very first sonic screwdriver is very unimpressive, but it was by necessity, basically.
It's very interesting. Well, I'm sure some people will be disagreeing, but I think it is.
Yeah,
I think, well, again, because it ties back. I mean, you're dealing with sort of production practices. You're dealing with, textural prop elements, you know, things which are within the story, which are of interest because they have, since that moment, have a longer history and importance to that narrative, to that story idea. The sonic screwdriver is far bigger than it was in Fury of the Deep. So you're looking at its origins. And we do as people love origins. We love that desire to sort of go into the past and find where things begin. So I think that's also a factor in it as well. Interesting enough, I was just having a quick look on the sonic screwdriver for, as we were saying about, that was in Thunderbirds. And it was apparently seen in two parts, which I didn't realize. I'd heard that it appeared in Thunderbirds, and the actual main handle piece is clearly evident in Thunderbirds with very little differences. But equally, the actual head, which isn't actually part of it, as that prop in Thunderbirds, is actually seen in another Thunderbirds episode as a sort of like a speakerphone. So those two bits were both from Thunderbirds, which would later be joined together to make the sonic screwdriver. And the interesting thing about it, again, questionably, I suppose, but with Thunderbirds, it's interesting because Thunderbirds, you had a mix of, while everyone knows it was puppets, there were often a lot of shots, close-up shots, which were actually life-size, which would use human hands to deal with complicated actions which puppets can do, like picking up something or dropping something or turning a knob. And in that situation, the handle of the Sonic was in the life-size version, which is why it is off scale to the Sonic in the show. But the shot of it being used, the top end of it, the red top end, being used as a speaker is being used by the puppets, so it's a lot larger than it would be in Doctor Who. It's sort of the size of a fist. So it's interesting again where you see prop elements being used, but within Thunderbirds, being, as I say, it's two different type. Well, there's at least three different types of scales in Thunderbirds, but let's just talk about the two: the puppet size and the life size, human size for close-ups and medium shots. You're seeing it transformed again through sort of sizing. It's you know, again, as I say, people listening to this and they're driving along and they're just thinking, what the hell are they talking about? This is why I think it's interesting. Should we look at some of the other ones? Because there's quite a few on the list. We've talked about a few inadvertently. One that isn't on the list that I noticed years ago is the panel in, I think I mentioned this in a podcast before, the panel in Ark in Space where they need to shut off the automatic defense system in episode one is, I'm trying to think, is it reused? No, it is reused in the Spacefall episode of Blake 7. It's used on the London. It opens the airlock. It's the same panel. So it's, you know, again, these small things, if they're quite interesting props. And I think that's the other interesting thing about this, is it's not just about any prop creating value. Often the prop has to be of some sort of quality, and quality can mean different things. I don't think that's a fixed thing that makes it memorable. On that, it had a very unusual knob-shaped handle and a rung for the handle to drop down, which made it sort of quite an unusual prop, this thing in Ark and Space and Spacefall, which is why I remembered it. Sonic screwdriver, again, is because it's got certain qualities to it, which I think is what people like about it. Anyway, sorry, yeah.
No, no, I was going to say people notice all sorts of things, like from chairs being reused to particular jewelry being reused and so on. And, you know, that kind of stuff, you know, it's set dressing. They're going to be reused. And when you think about it, if it's an Earth-based story, you know, there isn't just one of those chairs or one of that piece of jewelry, you know. But when you think about those panels, like Ark in Space, they're a very definitive look, and whatever they are, let's talk real quick about the Daleks from the new series. The grating underneath the three ring section right underneath the domed head, mm-hmm. it's actually just a rubber pool mat for when you step out of the pool. You know, you have something to grip your feet. You know, water drips right through that. You know, and they just saw that and they thought that would be great. But that grating could be used for many other things, like spaceship fittings, wall panels, and so on. It doesn't mean that it's specific now to the Dalek, just because it's a very interesting looking piece, so they'll go ahead and reuse it. So you'll see things like the Ark in Space panel. But what you'll oftentimes find with those is that you won't just see that panel itself completely reused. It may be recessed into a wall somewhere, or other details added to it to make it appear different, repainted to make it appear different. But then you'll get other times where a prop, which has been specifically made, either for Doctor Who or for something else, will be reused within the same show again, completely unaltered. For instance, another story that's missing, but certain parts still exist, so you can still see this on the DVDs, is Galaxy 4.
Yeah.
And the androids, I believe they're androids in that story anyway, the android women, they use these specific laser guns that are very unique looking. Not a bad, you know, just an interesting, unique design. But and that was the 60s. And then you fast forward all the way to season 12 in 70, what, 4 or 5, with Tom Baker in Genesis of the Daleks. And the Doctor finds that very same gun alongside either a Khaled or a Thal soldier, probably a Khaled soldier, who's dead, you know, right next to a regular old Earth rifle. But that prop was completely unaltered, at least as far as I can tell. It was completely unaltered. It's just one's in black and white and one's in color now. But there's been such a gap between that, and people weren't meant to watch these shows more than once. No one would ever notice that.
No, absolutely. And if you did watch them more than once, it wasn't on your time. It would be a repeat. And so, again, with a few years between, you would be watching it fairly new. Yeah. You wouldn't be having that close proximity watch where you can go back and check and watch several times because you own it. It would be another event moment, if you see what I mean. It'd be an event because it'd be on at 5:15 or 6:30 on BBC Two. You'd watch it fairly fresh because you wouldn't have seen it for 3-4 years. So it's, totally different situation. I think some of the other times it can be interesting with props. And again, we should be doing podcasts on this, is when you sort of get those amalgamations of props within props. For instance, Scorpio in Blake 7 has very clear elements of the Millennium Falcon kit, Airfix kit, as part of its decal sort of bits. There's a word they use. Is it Greebles? Is it? I can't remember.
Greeblies.
Is it Greeblies? They used for all the sort of bumps that you'll get on these sort of props,
right,
on these ships. And you can see very clear evidence of that. And again, with Red Dwarf, there's elements of the Seven's Dalek kit in that prop. So you get props within props, which is kind of interesting. And I think what becomes more fascinating, we take this from the sort of fan perspective, and there's some great Facebook groups for this. Things like Space 1999, where there's, again, a massive fan following for not just the props, but the investigation of how the props were made to remake them in the same method that they were made originally. So, and as I'm sure Brian will tell you, you get the same with TARDISes, especially police boxes and things like with the Fresnel lamps. You know, how can you find the original materials to actually remake these things as they were made? So you're not just doing facsimiles, you are actually finding those swimming pool mats or whatever to actually make those bits. So you're making them as authentically as possible. And people do that a lot for Moonbase Alpha. They study Moonbase Alpha from Space 1999, looking for those elements, which tend to be quite often, because as you say, done on the cheap, things that would be down the hardware store. or things that would be down from the kitchen Tupperware aisle, you know, and these sort of things would become these iconic, would be transformed into these props, which would become these iconic elements of the show. So there's so much going on here, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah, and sometimes, too, it's just there's a need for a prop that isn't anything special, you know, or at one point for one episode, they wanted it to be special. But since they've already made it, hey, you know, we might as well reuse it kind of thing. And like, for instance, a one that doesn't need to be special, going with Night of the Doctor when Paul McGann was going to regenerate into the war doctor to become a warrior. And then he was given a chalice with a special potion in it. They wanted that chalice to look interesting. They didn't just want to hand a paper cup over to the doctor with a potion in it, you know, so they picked this rather unique looking chalice. But it's just a prop within the BBC props department. So by the time you get to series 9, there's a prequel before the first episode of series 9 called The Doctor's Meditation, where the doctor is drinking from the same cup, you know. And if you want to, going back to that fan theory thought that we had before, you can say that the war doctor took that cup with him. It was his thing, and it's just been in the TARDIS, and that cup is now the doctor's. If you want to just sit there and be more of a realist, it's just a prop that was used. They had a need for him to drink out of a cup, so they used a cup, you know. But then you get a prop, for instance, this one. I personally think this one was made because I don't think I've ever seen a headset look this way. But somebody can correct me if this is a 60s or 70s piece of technology. But the headset that is worn in The Green Death to basically be controlled by Boss, it's just this big silver headset. It looks like headphones, but it's just a big metal chunk. Like, I don't know how you would ever wear this. It looks like you're trying to turn a human into a Cyberman, in my opinion. But it later shows up in three more Doctor Who stories, I believe, Planet of Spiders, Underworld, and Warrior's Gate. All very, like, really unaltered. It just served the need for that particular story. But that one was quite a unique look versus a chalice, which, yes, it was a unique looking chalice, but a cup is a cup, and basically, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's some even more blatant ones which are on the list, which I remember, again, as a child looking, because obviously when we were children, making us sound old, there wasn't, as we've said before, there wasn't a horrendous amount of merchandise. Certainly there wasn't a much of video merchandise, because there wasn't that many video ways to actually see things. So a lot of what you got was from books. And I'm going to refer to the Claws of Axos and Seeds of Doom, the reuse of the crinoid, which was just sort of slightly augmented by the looks of it become reuse of the Axos as a crinoid in Seeds of Doom. And there was very little that referenced it. There was just pictures. And for me, it was very confusing. And I was like, you know, are they meant to be the same? Are these stories have exactly the same monster in, but they're called different things? Are they meant to be the same? Is there a reference in the story like this? You know, is this just a prop reuse? And there wasn't that information to give you that clarity. And there wasn't even that much image. There wasn't that many images around to actually make even cross comparisons. And I remember the image I remember of having of the Seeds of Doom was black and white, and the image was of the Claws of Axos, I'd say, was a color one, which is sort of kind of funny because, you know, a lot of the Claws of Axos was left in, we only had the black and white footage left for some of the episodes. Right. So it was kind of weird to have it the wrong way around. So I wasn't sure what color the Seeds of Doom crinoid was, or whether it was just a total copy of the Axos one. So, you know, you get these sort of weird things as well when they reuse props. It can become confusing. But I still think the saddest thing, as you say, I mean, for props, they are just props. For prop people, they're just props at the time. So like we said with the Avengers, that Cushing police box being destroyed as part of that story. Yeah. And yet they are no longer just props. Through history makes them into sort of artifacts of those eras. They become as essential in some respects as the videotapes of Doctor Who are, you know, the missing videotapes. Yeah. Because at the time their value's not considered. It is a loss to future generations, where, you know, that Cushing police box was a fascinating artifact, you know, for people who are enthusiasts. But
yeah. And you know, some prop makers will value their prop enough that, for instance, when you go back to the invasion in Doctor Who, not the invasion, I've forgotten the full name of this story now. But anyway, when the Sonic Screwdriver was destroyed in the classic series and
Visitation.
I knew it was one of them. Thank you. It just wasn't coming to me. They obviously didn't destroy the real prop. They made a plastic version and blew that up. You know, either they just thought, hey, look, a plastic one's going to blow up easier and safer. Or they were like, we can't destroy this thing. It's such a piece of the show. Which, of course, is sad when you realize that the prop was, it went missing somehow from the BBC archives. There's many different stories for how it went missing, but the only one true fact is that it went missing. It's gone. But there's another side of things, too. Like for instance, well, real quick, finishing that thought, the police box, the Doctor Who police box being used in the Avengers and being blown up. If that police box, there's kind of two thoughts for these kinds of things. If it was used in the Avengers as a regular prop and then one day they decided to blow it up, kind of like the X-Files office in season 5 when they set the X-Files office on fire because they moved from Vancouver to L.A., they knew they had to rebuild the sets. You know, you either destroy the real thing like they did with the X-Files office, or you go ahead and make a replica like you did with the Sonic Screwdriver to destroy that. But a lot of times when you make the replica, it's because there's still some worth left in that prop. They saw the worth. They wanted to keep it. Some prop makers just want to keep it in their warehouse. Someone wants to take it from the show. They think maybe we'll reuse it again. Or then you have some things like the sets from the X-Files where it was just, hey, we have to remake these. Can't take them with us. Let's do something big with it.
Mm.
But then there's a flip side of all of this, too, which is, as we said, they become so iconic to the fans. We're so used to the way that they look that when you do remake a prop for a story, let's say when you get to Star Wars, The Force Awakens, and you're going to remake Luke Skywalker's lightsaber for Rey to discover, you could have gone two ways with it. You could have gone done a reasonable facsimile and just said it was that same one, which really would have upset fans who are into every detail of that lightsaber, and other people who just knew what it basically looked like wouldn't care. Or you can remake it like they did actually do in The Force Awakens and make it be like a best of the best prop, which is accurate and you know, basically every detail of all the best parts of the props before. But then you get other instances where when Doctor Who restarted again in 2005 and they had to remake the police box prop, rather than use actual plans for a police box or use the plans from the BBC archives for the police box that was made. And I understand that the reason they did this was because they wanted the prop to be larger for specific needs within the show. They still could have just rescaled the old classic design, just larger. They went ahead and they remade a prop that was very much more basic, not as detailed. I don't really know the best word for that, but it's just, it's nice. I'm used to it now. I like it now. I appreciate it now. But when Series 5 first came around, Series 1 first came around, we all looked at it and said, like, what the heck is this box? Like, why didn't they make a proper police box? But then you get other instances where they need K-9. For a story in series 2, and rather than remake K-9 as a you know, basic facsimile of what he was, they reused an actual prop from the classic series, which is great because we all looked at it and just said, wow, that's him, that's K-9. You know, we didn't have that same kind of feel that we did when the police box was completely remade from the ground up.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And it, at the same time, you know, again, I suppose we've talked about this before, so we won't go on to it too much. But when you actually see the act, because I think the sad thing with the police box remake for the new series is that the same police box design was reoffered for the Matt Smith period and turned down. And it had been really great. And I'm going to quickly share this with Brian, and we'll obviously put this on the show notes, but as far as I'm aware, this was what was offered, because I believe it was Matt Savage, I think his name is, who was the one who was and you can actually see it as it would have been for the Smith generation, and it's just so much more historically, like I say,
if, oh,
you,
sure. Like,
if you wanted the Cushing, you're as close to a Cushing as you'd have got.
Yeah, it's a very classic looking box. The steps are there under the police sign. The shape of the entire box is more correct. That base is a little too flat for me, but it's there. Yeah, and it would have been nice. And, you know, I have to be honest and say there's a part of me that was glad that both for the Smith and the Capaldi eras, they didn't redo the box into a classic style, because if they ever do that, and they're going to, someone's probably going to come along. If they ever do that, then all of a sudden the series 1 through 10 box is just going to be the worst box ever created for Doctor Who. But now it's like, well, it is what it is. It's there. It's another version of the box. You know, maybe the longest running style of the box. Who knows? That's just my own stupid reservations about it. But no, it would have looked nice, and I gladly would have welcomed it. And it is a shame that they didn't do that. Instead, it was, again, a lot of these reused props, a lot of these repurposed props from other TV shows or films within the show, they're all just cost-saving measures.
Yeah.
So when it came time to do the Matt Smith era, Stephen Moffat didn't really get a brand spanking new budget. And even though he may have gotten some more money, he had new cast, new prop makers, not completely, but new set designers, new producers, new costumers, everything new to kind of repurpose. And so making an entire new police box, when for a TV show like Doctor Who, you don't make, certainly in since 2005, you don't make one police box prop. You make several.
Yeah.
You know, because they're going to take on a lot of abuse. They're going to serve different functions. There's going to be one that is, as what's called in the prop world, a hero prop, which is the one that you're going to shoot whenever you want the box to look pretty and nice and close up. And then you have the stunt prop, which can do things like location shoots, long distance shots. And it doesn't always need to look pristine, because in the angles that it's going to be seen, in the long shots that it's going to be seen, it'll look just like it's supposed to look. You won't see the faults. The problem oftentimes with hero and stunt props is that limitations with filming, when you're on set, you have specific needs. You can't always wait for the hero prop. So the stunt props usually get more close-ups than they're supposed to, which leads to a lot of replicator nightmares in the end of things. But, you know, so for Matt Smith's era, trying to make an entire brand new couple of boxes just wasn't really even going to be the case. I mean, we talked about this before on the podcast, going back to Legopolis. They had built a new prop for season 18, a new police box prop for season 18, but they had a need in Legopolis to show two police boxes next to each other. So they used the old box that was already decommissioned. They built new parts for it to try and make it match as best they could the brand new box, so that they could get away with that. And then, of course, I think they use it a couple more times after that as well. There's also another aspect that I find interesting with filmmaking, which is, you know, as we said, a lot of these things are cost-cutting measures. They don't have enough money to do what they want to do, so you either make a smaller item and just settle with that, or you repurpose items. You know, you make your money stretch how you can. But then you have other things, which let's talk about the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who. There's two good instances here. The scenes on Gallifrey when the Daleks are invading and Daleks are being blown up during the Time War. Those Daleks are not scaled model Daleks. They're actually either the 12-inch or the 18-inch remote control Daleks. I can't remember which is which, but where Nick Rabato had to actually make them look as good as he could to match the actual full-scale props. But these were toys that were created by a toy company and sold to people like us and children to play with, now repainted and refurbished to work in the show. And they did similarly with the War Doctor's sonic screwdriver. Rather than turn out a new metal prop for John Hurt to play with, they took the Fourth Doctor character option sonic screwdriver toy and redressed it to be a prop within the show for the War Doctor. Which is just, it's crazy when you think, like, he's the only doctor to have a plastic sonic screwdriver, aside from the whistle going all the way back to Patrick Troughton's era, which is Bakelite, which I assume is a type of plastic anyway. I don't recall that material myself in my lifetime, but it's just interesting the lengths that they'll go, because James was talking about kit bashing before, where basically you'll take old battleships, old pirate ships, spaceship props, and what you do is you take all the best bits of each of those things and you put them together to make something completely new, sometimes over top of a model that you've designed that just needs dressing, and sometimes you make that model completely out of all those bashed parts. So you're basically taking toys, turning them into something new, whereas here in the 50th anniversary, they took toys and used them exactly as what they were, just dressed them a little bit differently.
Of course, you can take that back to things like Planet of the Daleks, where you were using, and Power of the Daleks,
yes,
where you were using toys as well to, for the Daleks as well. I think the, one of the final points I think is worth making is that this isn't, as we say, we're talking about cost cutting, but there's often an assumption that this is just something that's done for shows which are cheap. And I was just thinking, because I've just got a picture of it in front of me, things like if you look between Star Trek 2, 1 and 2 and 3, you see massive cost-cutting choices in those films, down to the shuttle which delivers Spock in the first film, the small model of that being used as a communicator in the third. There's nice. The regular one is the same space station which is seen at the beginning of the motion picture turned upside down. You know, you have these things where, and the amount of reuse of stock footage in between those films is massive. But the point being is, you know, these sort of questions of budget are on all scales, and it's very narrow-minded to assume this is just a sort of silly Star Trek, Doctor Who, Blake 7, you know, Thunderbirds, cheapy television show things. These sort of ideologies go across the board. And again, if you go to Star Wars and you look at those props, you know, the iconic blaster is a German Mauser. The the lightsabers, all the lightsabers in the original ones are just the photo lamp handles with a few little bits of things stuck on them. Again, cheap ways of making sort of solid looking props.
And we've already pointed out that the spacesuit for one of the characters was reused in Doctor Who, which reused it from a 60s sci-fi movie.
Absolutely.
But then one of those other bounty hunters within that same scene was an android, and his head was used in the cantina scene in the first Star Wars movie. They just repurposed that and made it an android for the second Star Wars movie.
And how much of the set work from Alien, which was filmed over in the UK, was right. reintegrated into things like Doctor Who and Red Dwarf and all sorts. That has been sort of quite quintessential. So this crossover, as you say, is a lot of it is to do with budgetary and collectiveness of archival or items that can be used, or even, as you say, sometimes stuff which is like in Fury of the Deep, which is possibly just stuff on the set, which is reused because it covers a requirement, necessity. And I'm sure there's more examples of that if we can think of them. But
we're leaving off one of the best reuses, in my opinion, which really shows a great mind for cost saving, which wasn't necessarily them saying, hey, let's go the cheap angle on this. They were being very wise when they thought of this and realized they had a good option here, which was Fires of Pompeii, filming their story, Doctor Who's episode Fires of Pompeii, filming their story on the HBO TV series Rome, actual sets.
Yeah.
So they didn't have to make their own sets for this story, or at least not many for the story, because they were able to have access to a TV show that already took place in the era they were setting their TV show, and they were able to work out a deal to go film on those sets, which is also not all that uncommon. Other TV shows and films have done similar. But that here you have, you know, you could probably go match up sets very well. Maybe they were slightly redressed, who knows? But you can probably go see them all throughout the story Rome, the series Rome, when you're looking through that particular story.
Mm. Absolutely. Well, I think we've pretty much come to the end of this conversation, although it could go on for much, much longer, technically speaking, as I think you indicated at the beginning, because there's just so many levels to it. We have always talked about doing a sort of short podcast on this sort of subject. And if that is something that interests you, then let us know. It's something which I think there's a lot to talk about. If you have any comments on this episode, as you say, just let us know. I think Facebook is often a common way of doing it, but there are various ways to contact us. But given I don't actually bother, I don't know what they are. But I would sort of say the Facebook one's probably the one that people use.
We'll
go with that. We'll go with that. We'll be back soon. I think we'll probably be doing a commentary soon once Christian is back on his feet. A lot of things going on in the Corley world at the moment, which is keeping him out of podcasts largely. And we will catch you again another time.